Well, that's the Nigerian national anthem introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, a weekly blog talk radio show with your show host, Andrew Harrod, where we like to look at important current events for conservatives and others around the world. Today, we want to look at Nigeria and discuss issues there involving jihadist terrorism and enslavement with Kyle Apps, who is the co-director of the International Committee on Nigeria, or ICON, which recently helped organize an ad hoc committee to free the slaves of Nigeria, the CFSN. And they had on last April 8th a protest, a demonstration in Minneapolis, Minnesota, the home district of Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, outside of her office. As well, in Minneapolis, they placed up a billboard bringing attention to the issue of enslavement of Muslims and non-Muslims by various jihadist terrorist groups in Nigeria, like Boko Haram. I'm trying to get Ilhan Omar and other Americans to give more attention to these matters, particularly given Omar's position as vice chair of the U.S. Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Africa and Human Rights. So to discuss these issues, we have Kyle Apps. Welcome to the show, Kyle.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for having me.
Well, starting out here, just describe your group, ICON, the International Committee on Nigeria, and its ad hoc committee to free the slaves of Nigeria, CFSN.
Sure. So the last line of the national anthem that you played, if you the lyrics is to build a nation where peace and justice reigns, and that's where ICON kind of got. So myself and my co-founder Stephen Inada, who is a Nigerian, met in 2000, and we did various programs throughout Nigeria on holistic leadership and building communities from the grassroots up, helping people to see themselves as leaders. And then eventually he came over to the States. I returned from Nigeria, and then we started International Committee on Nigeria, and we've been advocating for Nigeria since 2016.
Interesting. And we were discussing shortly before, you have fairly extensive background on Nigeria. You've lived there, and your family's part of your family is from there, correct?
Right. So my wife and I moved over there in 2000. I went as a single in the 90s, came back, got married. We raised a family over there, and then my daughter was born there. My son was 1 year old when we left over there, and they consider themselves a lot of times more Nigerian than American.
Well, interesting. Well, discuss what is the nature of conflict in Nigeria? Why is there fighting there, and what's going on there?
Well, as you know, Nigeria is a former British colony before it was all colonized and demarcated by the warring European countries, they were a conglomerate or groups of different Nigerian ethnic groups. So you had Fulani, you had Hausa, you had Igbo, you had Tiv, you had Yoruba. You had different groups, over 400 different ethnic groups kind of in the different areas that are now Nigeria. So when the British came and they started to take over and take some of the resources out, they ruled in the south, but they couldn't really get their hands in the north. And then eventually they used, by extension, they got the Hausa Fulani group to kind of rule for them on their behalf. You know, and that's where a lot of the tension really began, is when these groups started to domineer and take advantage of other smaller groups, and that's where, you know, people continue to be oppressed, enslaved, as we would say, to this day.
Yeah, Nigeria is interesting. I found it interesting in the history that people often sometimes talk about a kind of a three-part division of the country, that in the north, the northern section of the country, you have the Hausa Fulani people, as you mentioned, as the dominant group. And then in the southwest, there's the Yoruba. And then in the southeast, there's the Igbo as the dominant group. In particular, there was a division in Nigeria in the Biafra Civil War of 1960 to 1970, a very bloody major conflict in Nigeria. Hello?
Yes, hello.
Oh, yes. a little problem. But anyway, and there's, of course, then a sectarian divide between North and South, Muslim North and Christian South. In this conflict, when you talk about conflict, are conflicts between the Hausa and the Fulani and these groups that they're attacking predominantly Christian? Is this religious or economic, or is it a little bit of both? What is the nature of conflict in Nigeria?
Well, I mean, if you read reports coming out of the State Department, U.S. State Department, you'll see it's climate change, it's just economic, it's unemployment. It's not that. It's ethno-religious. So the North, the North is predominantly Muslim, and as you mentioned, South is predominantly Christian. Well, you have the Yoruba, there's a large number of Muslims that are within that group, and they intermarry. So their own people are marrying Christians and Muslims together, and they don't have any issues. There's zero issues coming out of the Southwest. But when you get to the Middle Belt in the North, that's where the battleground is. The North, they've instituted Sharia law in 12 states, which is counter constitution. I don't know how that was even allowed. There's different ways of excluding Christians from the government jobs of teachers, civil service, police, army. So these kind of tensions and divisions are very rampant up in the North, and that's where the Fulani, who, if you look back 200 years ago, when Uthman Danfodio came in outside of what is the boundary of what is today Nigeria, came in and set up called a jihad and set up this whole emirate system and conscripted the Hausa group. It was never Hausa Fulani are not one tribe. Fulani are one, Hausa are a separate thing. So the Fulani and Hausa now are together because that's the way the jihad set it up. They ruled using the language of Hausa, and they learned the language. They used it to rule and dominate the people, and that's how Islam took a foothold in the 1800s. And to this day, the emirate system is based on what Usman Danfodio did back in 1800.
That's interesting. Yeah, I've heard that name, Usman Danfodio, as being this sort of jihadist leader, this emir. I guess the date I've seen is he set up some rule in 1806 or so. You mentioned Sharia. So you say there's some 12 states that now have Sharia law implemented on the local level. I believe Nigeria has about 36 states. What percentage of the population now then in Nigeria is living under Sharia?
Yeah, that's a good question. If a third of the states are under the rule, then it's easy to say that at least a third of them are ruled by Sharia, and it could be even closer to half. So of 200 million people, we're talking nearly 100 million people have Sharia law as their guide. And it existed before. Sharia courts existed, but it was only for those who are Muslim. So if you're a Muslim and you wanted to have a case taken into the Sharia court, that was your right. Otherwise, there's traditional courts that are at the same time. But the Sharia courts always existed. But then to have a governor come and say, "I want to be ruled by the Sharia law," was against the Constitution. And for a couple of years, it was fought. But then eventually, it was just allowed to happen. And to this day, it still is occurring.
Yeah, I believe the first state that in Nigeria that implemented such Sharia law in 1999 was Zamfara, if I'm saying that correctly. Zamfara. Okay, yes. And as you mentioned, it's an interesting question how this was implemented. The constitution of Nigeria that started out in 1960 when Nigeria became independent, as you indicated, it allowed for Sharia law for personal matters if individuals want to choose that. So a Sharia civil law on issues of like family life or inheritance, but you know, not for any sort of criminal code. I mean, now there have been states in northern Nigeria that have implemented things like, you know, flogging, you know, amputation of hands for stealing and so forth, these Sharia punishments. But the constitution first implemented in 1960, and then successive constitutions in 1979 and 89, I believe in 99, have all taken over this language that Nigeria is supposed to be a non-sectarian, you know, there's supposed to be religious equality throughout the state. How has Sharia been able then to take hold in Nigeria? What has been the reaction of Nigerians to the local governors implementing Sharia?
Well, they continue to say that it doesn't affect the Christians and this and that, but you know, there's been stories where a Christian woman was accused of this, and unfortunately people got involved and the case was thrown out. But if there weren't people advocating on their behalf from the inside and from the outside, like ICON, people would be, you know, this would be allowed to go ahead. So it's, it's confusing. You know, the 1999 Constitution had its issues, but they basically set up Nigeria when it came out of the military dictatorship to kind of be run like the U.S. So imagine the U.S. having, say, Wyoming and Minnesota run a Sharia law. That would be confusing, baffling, how that would even be allowed. So that basically what's happening is you have the Nigeria system, which is run like the U.S., where you have the presidential, the judiciary, the legislative branches, and yet you have another whole component, the Sharia law, being able to run a third, if not half, the country.
And that's interesting. I mean, think of the American Constitution. Of course, it guarantees in Article 6, if I recall correctly, a Republican character to all the states, right? All the states of the United States are supposed to have this Republican character, and you also have then over time you've had what's called the incorporation of the Bill of Rights to the states, such that the First Amendment guarantees of like no establishment of religion and so forth also apply to state and local governments. But of course here in Nigeria, you have these local states implementing Sharia. I mean, there've been famous cases, like you probably recall you were living in the country at the time in about 2002 or so, shortly after September 11th attacks of Al-Qaeda, there's this famous case of a Nigerian woman was going to be stoned to death for adultery. She was pregnant, and on that basis, she was not married, so it was decided that she had committed adultery, and once she gave birth, they were going to stone her to death. New York Times, for example, did a Sunday magazine story on it. It became a very famous case. It was ultimately stopped. Why is Sharia being implemented in these states? I mean, how popular is it among the people? Why did people in these northern states want it?
I don't even think they realized that there was something before, right? You know, you talk to most of them, as Muslims, they believe that they need to be guided by the Quran and the Hadith and all the things the Prophet says, but they don't understand that there's a separation when it comes to the legal issues of the country. So I just think they everything is so intertwined with their faith that they don't see the separation, and for them it's not a problem. So that's why when there's any sort of opposition or any sort of discussion on it, they tend to get a little violent. You know, we have any you remember the cartoons that came out? I think it was in 2004. There was another case where a Muslim woman, there's just so many different things that happen. And people see where, and they react in the news, and they get violent. They start to burn anything that's remotely affiliated to the West, whether it's a school, a bank, a church. They target what they think is the evil West, which is Christianity as well. So they whenever there's a threat to their Islamic faith, they tend to rise up and violently protest. And I think that's where the Boko Haram kind of grew out of those sort of root and took hold with the youth that were disillusioned with what was going on in Nigeria and wanted to be a pure Islamic nation. And that's where it kind of grew and grew and grew. And now it's the most one of the world's violent jihadist terrorist groups.
Yeah, Boko Haram, I mean, its name means haram, prohibited, and Boko, I guess, is a sort of like slang term in Nigeria for book. And the name is translated Boko Haram, meaning Western education is prohibited, and it's sort of this common name for the Arabic name for this group was if I pronounce it right, Jamaatul Sunna Lidawati Wal Jihad, this congregation of the people of the Sunna for preaching the Sunnah and waging jihad. Discuss this group and other jihadist groups in Nigeria a little bit. Where does Boko Haram come from? What's its strength? What's its relationship to other groups like, say, Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State around the world?
So they've given their allegiance to Islamic State. So all their sort of ways and means of doing things now, from capturing things on videos to having a slick website and releasing things, is all thanks to the Islamic State. They do all these sort of very similar propaganda issues. Their whole thing kind of came out of, some say it came out of a political thuggery. They were hired local boys that would go and intimidate other candidates or other people to vote for their guy or not vote for this guy. And then they kind of became disillusioned with the politics and then started to see the group as a factor. And they kind of solidified themselves in this really extreme form of Islam. And and became very violent and very anti-government, anti-establishment, and wanted to purify Islam, kind of very similar to what Usman Dagbodia did back in the 1800s of purifying Islam and calling a jihad. And that's what Boko Haram did in 2009, declaring a jihad and ultimately wanting to destroy all Christians and any institution that was affiliated with the West.
Well, this is, you mentioned now again, I guess I've never really personally studied this specifically that much, but Usman Dagbodia, you say he actually wasn't in what is now today Nigeria, but he came from outside the territory. And so it was under him that this north was Islamified then. So discuss that history there. How did the north of Nigeria become a Muslim majority?
So before Usman Dagbodia came, there was Islam because it was a trading route, right? So from the Middle East all the way to Senegal, there's kind of these routes that historical routes that people came and traded camels for salt and for different things. And they were a loose Islamic country. The South was primarily Christian from the slave trading, from different things, missionary activity. And then I think Usman Dagbodia came from what is now Niger. Fulani are nomadic people. So Usman Dagbodia is Fulani, very nomadic people. So they take their cattle in the summer, when it's raining in the north, and then when it starts to get drier, they tend to take these routes, go along the rivers and feed their cattle further south in what is Nigeria. So he saw that as an opportunity to buy Islam and thus performed his jihad and set up the Emirates. And even to this day, the Fulani in Nigeria, there's city Fulani, some who have taken up residence and settled down, but like our president, the president Muhammad Buhari, he's Fulani ethnic Muslim. So he's considered the ultimate Fulani, but yet there are Fulani who come and go from Niger to Senegal, to Chad, to Cameroon. So they're nomadic, and they don't align themselves with the nation. They align themselves with their ethnic group, the Fulani. And there's a group of them that are very militant, that are very anti-farm because the farmers set up structure and they want to destroy them at all costs. They end up killing farmers who are primarily Christian, setting up their, bringing their cattle and taking over their farmlands, refusing people to farm and, in fact, using those farmlands for their cattle.
Yeah, I guess it strikes me as I've read before that the Fulani are apparently considered the largest nomadic people in the world, and it brings back memories of what reading about American history. You had out west the sort of the conflicts between the ranchers, the cattlemen, and then say farmers or sheep herders, setting up wire and enclosing space, and so that led to conflicts. Well, of course, to say nothing of the settlement of the West and of America with people settling, these white settlers coming in and making farms and then coming into conflict, of course, with this nomadic Native American culture and populations. So thinking of Muhammad Bukhari, you mentioned that he's Fulani. How effective has the government been in fighting such groups like Boko Haram?
That's our biggest, if it wasn't so tragic, it would be a joke. He has done nothing. I mean, since his time in office 2015 to date, he continues to take American money, almost $500 million of Department of Defense, helping with training and equipment and military whatever, and he hasn't done anything. He'll show a few stories that, yeah, we did this, we stopped this, but they're still rampant. I mean, since 2009, they've been free to do what they need to do, Boko Haram. Same with the Fulani militants. He doesn't call them, he calls it a farmer-herder conflict. So there's two actual problems in Nigeria, the Boko Haram terrorists, and then the Fulani militant. So they're two different groups, and there's some reports that they sometimes are overlapping, sometimes they're working together, sharing arms or sharing intel. And if that ever comes about, then the whole country of Nigeria is going to be destroyed, and there's been very little to stop either Fulani militants or the Boko Haram from having their way in Nigeria.
Well, that's interesting. So there's kind of an interaction and an overlapping of sort of a theological, ideological conflict with jihadists like Boko Haram, and then on the other hand, these kind of socioeconomic conflicts between sedentary farmers and grazers. And you say that most of the farmers then that are involved in this conflict, they're primarily from Christian background.
Correct, yes. There's a few up in the north, maybe Katsina State, that are – it's a historical battle between Fulani and the local farmers who were Muslim. But the majority of the battles, the worst battles, the highest death counts are within Christian areas.
I guess that brings up an issue. Well, how did then – why are most farmers from Christian background, and how did – Christianity spread in the past, and what is sort of the religious trends today among Christians and Muslims? Is one faith spreading over the other, or how are those two faiths interacting?
Well, I mean, even before the Sharia kind of happened and the Fulani militants started invading, there was trust amongst Christians and Muslims. You know, the story goes that Christianity came in through schools, through healthcare, through just organization. So a lot of people became Christians when they saw the work of their children living longer lives. So they started to hear more about what Christianity is, because there's medical centers. The schools, a lot of the schools back before the independence were run by mission organizations, whether it's the British or European or even American. So a lot of the development in Nigeria was attributed to Christians, and that's where a lot of people gave up on their traditional beliefs and became Christians. So even Islamic beliefs, some Muslims became Christians as well, because they saw it as a very active and a functioning religion. Well, as you said before, the Constitution, that's freedom to choose. No one can force you to convert, and that was never an issue. No one sat down and says, well, you can't go to the school unless you become a Christian. We have many, many stories of governors, even presidents who were Muslim and went to a Christian school, whether it's Catholic or Methodist or Baptist. But yet some Muslims did become Christians. But yet when a Muslim becomes a Christian, the family disowns them. In fact, some families want to kill them. So there's a tension when a Muslim becomes a Christian. When a Christian becomes a Muslim, there's just doubt and how did this happen, whatever, but there was no violence towards the person. When a Muslim becomes a Christian, it's a very it's a community-wide approach to destroy that person and convert and reconvert them back.
Interesting. But then you compare, you've mentioned that among the Yoruba, the dominant group in the southwest of Nigeria, that you have a sort of mixed communities of Christian Muslims and even intermarriage. How are relations there among Christians and Muslims, and why do they differ from the other relations in the north and the middle belt of Nigeria?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there was even time, I think when September 11th happened here, September 7th was a Friday in Nigeria, and that's when the Muslim Christians really, the issue really became solidified in the middle belt. So there are Muslims from the south, from Yoruba, who are fleeing their lives because other Muslims are trying to kill them because they didn't think they were pure. So there's tension in between themselves as Muslims, between Yoruba Muslims and Northern Muslims, Hausa Muslims. So I think because the Yoruba have a strong ethnic tie to their language, their culture factors into their Christian belief system as well as their Islamic. They share that and they work together to continue to be unified. Whereas Islam in the north is very, you have to become this way of Islam and only this way and speak this and do that. And it's very, any outsider coming in, they say that you don't understand. So that they tend not to agree with them and just write them off as an outsider to begin with.
It's interesting. You discussed the spread of Christianity in Nigeria, and you focus on like schools and development activities among missionaries. And that precisely ties into the name of Boko Haram. Again, this idea of the book, Western education is prohibited, is haram. I was doing some reading on Boko Haram, went through a book that had a transcription of various past Boko Haram leaders, and they were picking up on this theme of saying, yeah, this education, it's not purely Muslim, it's mixed with Western ideas, and if you receive this education, then ultimately you'll turn away from Islam. So we have to stop that. I mean, one Muslim leader was saying, this education leads you to believe that rainfall comes from condensation, right, from natural scientific laws. But we as Muslims believe that rainfall just comes from an act of will of God. And so You know, we just can't accept someone rejecting the, you know, God's transcendent eminence and believing in these natural laws. So did Christianity spread historically then? Was it basically just sort of a peaceful process driven by missionaries?
Well, I mean, it was a combination between, so the British government allowed and actually assigned mission groups. So mission groups have to petition back in the 50s, even in the 40s, some in the 30s would come and write up, they want to do churches, they want to do schools, they want to do medical clinics. So the British government said, okay, you go to this area, you go to this area. So it was kind of divided up. That's why a lot of denominations in Nigeria are divided along ethnic lines, because they're grouped at church and the schools were either Methodist or Baptist from America or Reform from Europe or something like that. So there's a lot of divisions amongst themselves. But yet at the same time, it was a very strategic plan for the government to kind of divide up the country and make sure everyone got something. And it wasn't forced or coerced that you had to get treatment, you had to convert. So missionaries made problems or made certain mistakes, but I think by and large, their whole thing is seen as, Muslims would often say, they brought development, they brought progress to our area. In fact, where Boko Haram is, where started from in Maiduguri, used to be a very strong Kokan, it was a British-led group, as well as a brethren from Europe, or from England. And they kind of set up schools and clinics, and you see a lot of it, and now it's all been destroyed and burned down.
Yeah, but I believe that Boko Haram got it started in, if I'm pronouncing it right, Maiduguri State? Is that up in the northeast of Nigeria?
In Maiduguri, which is the city, and then Borno is the state.
Okay, right. Looking at this conflict, this jihadist violence that's ravaged Nigeria, why do groups like Boko Haram enslave people? Is there any Islamic doctrine justifying that? And I mean, we've heard of like sex slavery among, the Islamic State in Mesopotamia, Syria, and Iraq, and so forth. What do groups like Boko Haram seek through that?
Yeah, I mean, it's fear. So they come into villages like Chibok or Dapchi, where schoolgirls were taken captive, and a lot of them were forced to be wives. So sex slaves. They've continued to go into other places and take young boys or even young men and conscript them and train them. The Boko Haram, there's a man named Jacob Zen, an American, who has an unmasking Boko Haram. And he often gets the Boko Haram videos, and there's videos on there of young boys being trained in very radical Islamic jihadism thought, as well as being trained on weaponry. So these are young boys, maybe 10, 12 years old. So their goal is to run fear in the community into Nigerians, as well as to take them and use them for their purposes of wives, sex slavery, as well as child soldiers.
Yeah, I guess that brings then to mind the historical experience of the Ottoman Empire. Of course, infamously had the Janissary Corps and their culling if I say it right, the Deir Shirma, taking up young boys as slaves in the Balkans to be indoctrinated and enlisted into the Ottoman Empire and into the military and other parts of the Ottoman state. So I guess there's a similar parallel there of enslavement. You talked about the Dapchi case. One of your members in this coalition of the Committee to Free the Slaves of Nigeria is this LIA Foundation that's dealing with this LIA Sharobu teenager, a female, who was taken on February 18th, 2019, if I recall correctly, along with 109 other girls. Now, the other girls apparently have been released, but LIA is still being held captive because she refuses to renounce her Christian faith. Discuss that case of LIA Sharobu and what has happened to the other girls now that they've been released. I mean, did they just say, "Oh, we'll become Muslim," and then they got released and now they're free and they can just forget Islam? Or discuss that case there.
Yeah, that's one very dear to my heart. I met with the parents. It was February 19, 2018. It's been over 3 years since she was taken captive. So she was one of very few Christians in that area. So it was about an hour from the from Maiduguri, from Borno, from that area. So it's very up in that northern east part where Boko Haram is very active. So she was at a boarding school, and they came in the night, and all her Christian friends, about three or four of them, were able to run and be free. But she was caught with about 109 other girls, and those mainly were Muslim girls, all Muslim girls. So when they were captive, they were taken on a bus. There's a Lake Chad up there. They were taken probably into islands on Lake Chad. And they kept telling her this, this, and this. They kept trying to help her, say, if they ask if you're a Muslim, just say these words and they'll believe you're a Muslim. She said, no, I'm a Christian. I was not told to become a Muslim. My parents are Christian. Why would I convert? And then eventually they came to her and said, we'll let you leave if you convert. She said, no. They took her and called her a slave for life, and she's been in captivity ever since. In fact, the U.S. government, the French government, the British government all had drones. They had a huge base up in Niger, and they were ready within days to help the Nigerian government free these girls. And I don't know what happened. The Nigerian government refused to engage the foreign government. They said, no, we're negotiating. They negotiated. All girls were released except for one. Five girls died during that time, but Leah was the only girl left behind.
Oh, I see. So most of the other girls were already Muslim, so Boko Haram was willing to release them, but they really want to they really made a point of saying to Leah, look, if you want to get released, you're going to have to convert. You know, you discussed there in the case of Niger and American and French and other governments, you know, having drones and other military resources nearby to ready to intervene. What are the international factors of Boko Haram and other jihadists in Nigeria for Africa and the wider world? What linkages are there? Is there, you know, is there more spillover from Boko Haram into Africa, or could it potentially be become, say, a base for any other terrorists like Al-Qaeda or Islamic State that might come there to seek to attack, say, the West, Europe, or something?
Yeah, so I think that's the thing. I mean, so the whole of West Africa is a mess. Mali, you have different various Islamic State terrorist groups there, Burkina Faso, Niger, all the way into parts of eastern Senegal. So there's this, the U.S. government, the French government, the British government have been pouring money into these situations, trying to either train local troops to do combat or to do invasions or whatever to stop these sort of things, but it's just not working. I just don't know if there's not accountability or what, but the threat is that these groups they're not connected, but they're connected to Islamic State. So Boko Haram senior members have traveled, whether it's to Sudan or former Sudan or Somalia or wherever, they've been trained up, they've been taught in ways of doing these things that Islamic State has been doing throughout the Middle East. And now it's the biggest grounds for terrorism now is West Africa.
Yeah, and as you mentioned before, this Boko Haram group, they've pledged allegiance to the Islamic State in recent years. I guess it was about a year after the Islamic State caliphate was announced in 2014 or 2015 or so. And, you know, so now they're the Islamic State in West Africa. They're this West African affiliate of the Islamic State and this supposed caliphate. Looking at the these issues in Nigeria, why have you focused on Ilhan Omar with this recent demonstration on April 8th in her home Minneapolis district, as well as you've set up a billboard calling attention to this matter in Minneapolis?
Well, she is part of, she's, as you said, the vice chair of the subcommittee on the House of Representatives Committee on Foreign Affairs, specifically Africa, Global Health, and Human Rights. Christopher Smith, we've been working with for many years, is the ranking Republican, and we've tried to work with Karen Bass, who's the ranking Democrat. We thought Ilhan Omar, who's a daughter of Africa, living here in the States, making pronouncements, saying things, but she needs to act and rise up for the cause of Nigerians. If she really truly believes words she says, then she needs to defend all lives in Nigeria, specifically those Christians who are being slaughtered, who are being killed, who are being taken, kidnapped victims, who are being turned into sex slaves, child soldiers, held in captivity. So we're just we chose her because we thought she would listen. You know, we didn't get any response from her office. We delivered a petition and signatures. We stood in front of her office. Their office was closed because of COVID, but we were told that the petition would be seen by her, or at least be acknowledged by her, but we have not heard anything since last week.
Yeah, I guess, you know, she would have, I've read in the news, perhaps your coalition mentioned it as well, that she had in the past criticized, like, police violence in Nigeria, right? So, but then the question arises, well, why is she not saying anything about these jihadist ravages? So you haven't received any response. She hasn't been receptive to your appeals. She hasn't done anything. Have you received support from others? You mentioned Chris Smith then and Karen Bass, the ranking members on this committee that have dealt with Africa. What sort of support is your coalition receiving?
So Chris Smith is the only person who's been vocal for many years. He's the only person that responds. Karen Bass acknowledged Leah Sharibu in a letter. That's about it. You know, it's very – so people like Karen Bass and Representative Ilhan Omar, they go for the low-hanging fruit. You know, this whole NSARS, which is not the disease, it's the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, which is the Black Lives Matter kind of petitions in Nigeria. That's easy to get on board with. Well, even that issue in Nigeria is all scattered itself. So, you know, there's problems, there's confusion on that. But we're talking – these are issues that have been going on for more years, for 20 years, if not further, that have been – America just refuses to take a stance on because of a special relationship that the U.S. government has with Nigeria. They're going to not say anything or not point out or not hold them accountable. You know, $1 billion when I think 2019, you know, aid, USAID, Department of State, military aid went into Nigeria. Where's the accountability? Where's the – a call to say, you've got to stop these things. This violence. Trump says it. You know, when he had Buhari in his office, he said, he even mentioned, we were able to help with a couple other groups write a letter that he took some talking points and was able to use to talk to Buhari, saying, there are Christians being killed, stop it. There's a girl still in captivity, release her, you know. Biden, we know what Biden did when he was vice president, so we're not expecting anything really out of this new administration or State Department. We hope, but, you know, that's why we're trying to call on both sides to rise up and to say things, speak out.
I see. So from Biden, then, you know, thinking of him as Vice President or Obama, do you expect more of the same from Biden as under Obama? I guess, you know, Obama was, I recall correctly, was criticized a lot for not really responding appropriately for Nigeria. I mean, for one thing, as you indicated, downplaying any sort of ideological dimension to the violence in Nigeria.
Yeah, I mean, it took them a couple of years to finally acknowledge that Boko Haram was a terrorist group. I mean, it was under Obama's watch, but that has been going on for years to try to say, look, Boko Haram is a terrorist group. I think it was 2012, 2015, finally. So, I mean, this wasn't a new thing or a recent, it was a clear-cut, they're a terrorist group, call them that. You know, and who became Buhari, President Buhari, became president under Obama's watch and under Kerry's guidance. So there's if you read the book by Good Luck Jonathan, who was the opposition candidate, he'll say that it was the U.S. government who feared and brought Buhari into power. So, and if you look back at 2015, we know who was president and vice president at the time.
Well, what about in terms of personnel in the Biden administration for Africa? What sort of choices has Biden made for personnel there? To handle Africa, State Department, Department of Defense, for that matter, what does that indicate?
Well, that's it. We had a great relationship with Ambassador-at-Large Sam Brownback, who was the Religious Freedom Ambassador in that department, the State Department. We helped set up the IRF, International Religious Freedom Roundtable, in Nigeria. We helped to work, bring people here to the States to raise the work and efforts, but now there's no one. There's no person in that office. It's vacant. They haven't filled it yet. We've called. We've written petitions to try to bring him or bring someone into power or bring it, put in that position. So, you know, we're confused because some of the people that that are lifers in the State Department are now in charge of certain administrations or certain departments or certain bureaus, and we're just not hearing any clear cut. In fact, they released a report, I think, February or March, that didn't bring up any of the issues that we thought they would. There was no discussion on Christian-Muslim tensions, ethnic, religious violence. It was all just farmer-herder, climate change. Boko Haram is still a serious threat, you know, standard stuff that really doesn't move the needle, doesn't do anything to help protect innocent lives in Nigeria.
Yeah, I guess climate change is, seems like, a, you know, whether you're talking about migrants from, you know, a crisis on America's southern border, or, you know, migrant waves coming to, from Central America and the United States or whatever else, climate change always seems to pop up as a favorite argument for any and all issues among more left-leaning, among Democrats and other other forces. But that's just, so I hadn't followed the news. So there hasn't been a replacement yet for Sam Brownback as the ambassador-at-large for religious freedom.
No, there's been discussions, maybe, but there's been no appointment yet.
And thinking of religious freedom, and it's, what is the status of Nigeria under the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, USURF? Is Nigeria now, or has it been in the past, I'm trying to recall, what is called a country of particular concern, a CPC, which is given to, you know, various countries like, say, Pakistan or Iran, to designate those countries in the world that are the worst abusers of religious freedom?
Yeah. So they were declared last year under the Trump administration. So they are CPC. And, in fact, we were able to get Leah Shribu listed as a prisoner of conscience about June of 2019. So there is precedent, and there are ongoing discussions on it, but it seems to be pushed back. And even that, to get Leah listed as a prisoner of conscience, to get Nigeria as a CPC, it's a hard-fought battle. You know, there are people inside that are stopping it along the way, whether it's a lobbying group from Nigeria that's in bed with certain people in the U.S. government, or it's just some unique discussions that seem to be happening. And this is ongoing, and yet no one's rising up and stopping it or calling attention to it.
Yeah, I believe according to the sort of casualty figures, Boko Haram is like, I guess after, I forget, I think maybe internationally after that, maybe the Taliban is like the second most dangerous terrorist group in the world. It's the in Nigeria, it's so many killings have gone on. What does a CPC in particular, what sort of effects kick in with a country of particular concern CPC designation?
Sorry, what was the question? I heard.
What does a CPC, country of particular concern designation, imply? What sort of effects take effect if that designation is given to a country?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, it's supposed to be, you know, less trade, less rights for leaders, and less whatever. So it's confusing because there's really nothing has changed, you know, as far as the relationship with Nigeria goes and the U.S. government. They still get aid. They still get sort of elite status in certain things because they're a trade partner. But, yeah, it's nothing's really changed.
Well, what sort of policies would your group recommend then to bring about change in Nigeria, to get this Muhammad Bukhari government under the President Muhammad Bukhari to take a more effective, active role in combating such jihadist groups?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is accountability. And again, we're not saying America is going to shine, going to go and shine like a star in the sky and solve the problem. But we're giving them money. We should have some accountability. So stop giving money until you get some answers, and those questions should be asked. What's going on? Why is there persecution of Christians? Why is there an onslaught of land grab where Fulani militants are taking over land that belongs to these Christian farmers? Why is Boko Haram continued to be on their own, doing whatever they want to do, killing, destroying, looting, doing all that stuff? You know, so once you start to get those answers, now you start to come up with a plan. You know, we can't keep throwing money at things. You know, they throw money so many millions of dollars towards relief and development, farm aid, which doesn't get into the right hands. It's corrupt, the system. You know, USAID grants is not going to the right people. You know, we've seen firsthand how people abused, lied on proposals and not used it well that they're supposed to.
And is, do you think in general, with Bukhari coming from this Fulani background, is it just simply, is it just a question of sort of his political support, his political base? Is he just sort of dragging his feet, not really acting against these jihadist groups and on other associated issues of, say, like conflicts among grazers and farmers, just because he doesn't want to alienate his support? I mean, what sort of political dynamics are there in Nigeria?
Well, I mean, politics is, once you're in for life. So whether you're president or your term is done, then you come some interest in some other way. You know, the politics in Nigeria is, it's not the joke in Nigeria is not election, it's selection. Who are we selecting to be president? Who are we selecting to be governor? You know, so right now the ruling party is APC. It used to be PDP. Now it's APC. So, you know, they're just by all means trying to hold on to power. So they lie. They put articles on in newspapers and do all these things and cheat the system, as it were. And another joke is that they want these conflicts to continue because they're getting outside money. You know, they're getting money from the EU, from the US, from the UK. So, you know, good crisis is a good income source. So.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, you can just sort of milk the cow and not really care. Now, Nigeria, how long have they had democratic rule? They came out of military rule. Did that end right before the 1999 constitution? Have they been able to maintain regular elections ever since?
So, yeah, 1960 was independent, and then they went through a series of different dictators and republics, as they call them. So I think they're on the fourth or fifth one now. And so 1999 is when all the Abacha had died and all the military had stopped, and the new elections came in, and a former general, Obasanjo, came to be the president in 1999. So he served 8 years, and Yar'Adua came in, died in office. Good Luck Jonathan was there. So they've had democratic rule since 1999, but they're all former generals. So even Buhari is a former military dictator.
Huh. So is the military really dominant in Nigeria? Is that the dominant institution?
Well, that's the biggest employer. There's estimates of a quarter, if not a fifth of the population is employed by the military some way, you know, either as on a base or as a soldier or whatever. So it's not, I don't think the fear of a coup is there or a general taking over again, but I think that it's a system that, you know, they tend to get a lot of clout and appointments.
That's interesting. Yeah, maybe you compare it to, say, like Egypt. You know, the military is really considered sort of the dominant institution. Egypt has a lot of industries and so forth that runs, and so the sort of the most effective, best-trained leaders in Egypt tend to be in the military and have the most connections, most influence. How large is the Nigerian military in its troop force in comparison to, you know, all the people who are as well in of course, you say that there are all these people employed by it, but what's the sort of troop strength?
Question. I mean, I think there's, you know, millions, you know, the army is the chief one, then they have a navy, they have different branches. But, yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think active forces is definitely in the millions. I mean, if it's 10 million or 15, I haven't looked at statistics recently, but it's very hard to get into. It's a lot of who you know. So they do a lot of screening, but a lot of times you have to have a sponsor, someone to say, take this guy or give this guy a shot, you know. Very disciplined, very structured, but they're very, very difficult to get in. But once you're in, you're basically in for life.
Well, thinking of political issues here in the United States and political support, how have churches and other groups in the United States responded to your campaign? Are churches getting involved? Are any other groups getting involved?
Yeah, that's what we're trying to do. So we've tried to get, you know, we started to start with the Nigerian churches that are here in the U.S. So there's a lot of Nigerians who either immigrated here through education or grew up here, you know, their parents went to school here, they grew up here, they were born here. So there's a lot of Nigerians in the diaspora, as they call them. So we're trying to work with them first. But at the same time, we're trying to work with Christian groups, churches, as well as the African-American churches. So we're really trying to broaden the reach and get people to aware of what's going on in Nigeria.
Well, I guess, you know, precisely in the season of Black Lives Matter, BLM, has there been any particular interest among African-Americans in the United States or any other groups for any particular reason?
Yeah, we've had mixed results. We've had a good success. There's a former NFL player, Benjamin Watson, who's very interested in what's going on in Nigeria. So he's joined us several times in different programs. He's brought along other African-American pastors from Maryland, another one from Georgia. And so it just takes one person to get involved and then share and spread and then bring their networks in as well. So.
Well, I guess on the other hand, you know, thinking of Ilhan Omar and campaigning to get her involved, given her sort of prominence, I mean, she has, I guess, a particular sort of star status. Have you received any pushback or criticism for being, like, bigoted or, as the phrase goes, Islamophobic for your focusing on such jihadist groups?
No, I mean, so if you look up from the outside and you're following the State Department's narrative far harder, the attacks tend to come. Well, you're just looking at it from one angle. Well, no, we're looking at it from within Nigeria. You know, we do work in Nigeria. We go to Nigeria. We lived in Nigeria. We live in Nigeria. We have people that are being attacked daily. If you see my phone, my WhatsApp account, and if someone ever took my phone, I'd be probably arrested for some gruesome pictures on it because there's daily attacks. People going to the hospitals. Arms being cut off, heads being split open. So these are real things. It's not just a narrative that we've cooked up. We're trying to expose it to the world. You know, people don't want to see gruesome pictures, but they're happening. People want to see facts and statistics. We have them. So, you know, these are the kind of things that people are, they want to run their mouth, but they don't want to look at the facts clearly.
Well, thinking of Nigeria and in this conflict, what would be the stakes for them? What sort of stakes if America are involved or the wider world? I mean, how important is Nigeria you know, what sort of threat is this conflict presenting? Could Nigeria break up or descend into civil war?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first off, as Americans, you know, people say to us all the time, well, why are we spending so much money? Point number one, let's not spend money. We don't need to. Let's have the solutions come from within. Let's look at the solutions and the targets. When you allow this farmer herder, when you allow these other narratives to go on, you're going to continue to throw money at it. Secondly, it's going to spill out. It's already spilled out. I mean, you've got people fleeing. There's sex trafficking coming from the south of Nigeria because people are afraid of their lives. So they're leaving. They have no jobs or whatever. Young girls are being trafficked through Libya, across the ocean, into Europe, into Italy. You know, you can look, just Google Nigeria sex traffic. You'll see hundreds of YouTube shows or BBC shows, you know, girls being leaving for a better life and being into slavery or sex traffic. Then you have people just the instability of Nigeria, the guns that are being trafficked across borders, you know, into places like Chad, into places like Niger and Mali. You know, they claim it came from Libya, but now Nigeria is probably distributing their own sort of guns from that. So the whole thing is it's already affecting the world. What is the world doing to keep Nigeria accountable and to help stop this? So I think that's the biggest issue now is it's no longer a Nigeria issue. I mean, the Igbos want to, again, break off. Biafra they created their own country, and that was the Civil War in 1967, and they continued every year. They marked that anniversary, and they continued to threaten that they want to break away. The Yorubas in the Southwest also are saying, maybe it's time we break away. So, I mean, the country could split. You know, it's not good because the resources and whatever would be, who knows how they would be divided, and that could cause further war and escalation of violence.
Yeah, of course, with the Igbo thinking, that's interesting you say that the Igbo, they really marked the anniversary of, I guess you say, the breakout of the Civil War in 1967 that lasted for 3 years until 1970. That's still a very vivid memory. And of course, for the Igbo in the southeast of Nigeria, there in the critical oil-rich river delta area of Nigeria. So that's very important for the entire country because such a critical oil resources are concentrated in that area. So Well, thinking of you know, these conflicts, that are groups like Boko Haram really popular among Nigeria's Muslims? I mean, how could you win hearts and minds among them to sort of decrease the influence of these groups and to diminish that threat from the north of Nigeria?
No, I mean, when they first started coming out and they bombed the UN in 2010, the Muslims would come out and say, that's not Islam, that's not what we believe in. So I don't, you know, I think a lot of their attraction becomes it's a job, it's this way of life of, you know, like a gang, you know, in a sense, right? So they want to get in that. They have access to weaponry, you know. They are able. They have sort of meaning and purpose. So that's where they really get their young boys to join, is because it's a status, it's a fear thing. So there's no religion that really, they're not attractive because of the religion. That's for sure.
So have various Muslim, what Muslim groups or leaders have come out against Boko Haram, and are they really winning them this ideological fight?
Well, when Usman Danfodi in 1800 set up the first emirate, it was the Sokoto emirate. So that's the Sultan of Sokoto. That's seen as the head of Nigeria's Muslim elite. So if you're talking Sunnis, that's who they align them to. So when they first start coming out, the Sultan of Sokoto would always make pronouncements, this isn't Islam, but didn't really engage, or said, maybe even said that they don't listen to him or whatever. So it's for the majority of Muslims in Nigeria, that's the Sokoto emirate is who they look up to, but it's not an effective negotiator with Boko Haram, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. So is this Sokoto emirate, does it have a sort of a memory among Muslim Nigerians as being a sort of a leading state or a powerful or advanced state, but Boko Haram has not been able to sort of claim that mantle to say, yeah, we're recreating such an Islamic state, so you should support us to sort of bring back those glory days?
Well, I mean, there's been, you know, conspiracy theories abound in Nigeria. They love a good story. So some say that they've said, well, you can go what you want to do, but don't you take over the Sultan, you know, you can't invade this area. So, you know, there's stories like that, you know, whether it's true or not, people don't know, but there's different things that have been aligned to certain Boko Haram being aligned to government figures that use it as their sort of evil tool. But, you know, who knows what backroom deals are going on in these things.
Well, closing out here the show, looking at this issue, what do you think Americans should do to support your group and to get involved in this wider issue of combating these threats and human rights abuses in Nigeria?
Well, I mean, you can start with going to Free Nigerian Slaves. It's Nigerian, freenigerianslaves.org, and there's a petition to Ilhan Omar. Then you can look at our conhelp, conhelp.org, and just get familiar with the facts. You know, again, we're not right now. It's Ramadan in West Africa, or in the whole world, and it's a very it's a unique time, because you can use this time to pray and reflect. But then Christians also use this time to talk to Muslims. Hey, what's bothering you with me? Here's what's bothering me with you, and then here's what I see is going on with the future, especially as it relates to Nigeria. So, you know, as we remember Nigeria, you know, it's not an island, it's not alone. It's a country that's one of America's favored countries, but it's a country of 200 million people that's being destroyed from within.
All right, then. Well, for our listeners out there, this has been another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to look at issues, important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And we've been discussing Nigeria here with Kyle Apps, the co-director and co-founder of the International Committee on Nigeria, ICON, which has recently formed the Ad Hoc Committee to Free the Slaves of Nigeria, CFSN. Well, Kyle Apps, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, join us next week for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.